It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You might be rethinking tonight's supper once you hear our guest, Chef Daniel Patterson. He has Qua, the Michelin two-star restaurant in San Francisco. There you taste through eight courses. Surprising courses like a bowl of grits that's really buttered popcorn, tomatoes with olive oil ice cream. You don't realize it, but you're eating mainly vegetables. Brilliantly done. A challenge a lot of chefs are taking on.
I love the challenge of making something with something really humble and making it as exciting as if the customer was getting kind of a traditional luxury ingredient. I mean, let's be honest, to make a beet as exciting as caviar or foie gras is, you know, it's got to be a pretty damn good beet.
It's not about vegetarianism, but about the challenge of the vegetable. Stick around for more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Hobie Wedler's been doing wine tastings in the Napa Valley, unlike any other. Now, he's been blind since birth and seemingly unfettered by it. He's always been driven by curiosity. This led to him becoming a serious cook, a doctoral student in chemistry, and that led him to wine, which took him to the Francis Ford Coppola Vineyard, where his own ways of opening up to wine led to his tasting in the dark wine seminars. Hobie, good to have you with us.
Thank you, Lynn.
Tell me, how did you get into wine?
So I was actually born and raised in Petaluma, which is in the heart of Sonoma County, which, as you know, is a big wine region of the world. And I've always had a love for sort of hyperlocality. And the thought that something around me, like a delicious grape from Sonoma County, was being sold all over the world, even when I was 9, 10, 11 years old, was fascinating.
And it was in your backyard.
It was in my backyard. And, you know, people have always told me, well, you're blind. You should focus on things that are non-visual. So maybe try to develop a palate. I mean, these were fantasies that people talked about when I was 8, 9 years old. And the fact that here I am right now is kind of ironic.
Well, and I know chemistry, you're going for your PhD in chemistry, and I know you've done a great deal of work in it. But is that one of the, that's a direct tie-in to wine.
Sure. I mean, wine is truly, there's two ingredients, yeast and grapes. And the chemicals in wine are what make wine smell and look the way it does. And if it weren't for chemistry, you know, we wouldn't understand a lot of those properties of wine.
You run wine tastings at the Francis Ford Coppola Vineyard, and they are literally blind wine tastings. How do you do this? Explain how this works.
So Francis Ford Coppola Winery up in Geyserville, which is just a few miles north of me in Petaluma, in the heart of Sonoma County, they called me in 2011 and said, hey, do you want to host a blind wine tasting? And I said, well, I'm a self-taught wine enthusiast, and I love wine. I love talking about different abilities that people have when they're temporarily blinded. Let's go with it. So basically what we do is we put a blindfold on people in our reception area. And then we walk them up a long flight of stairs and down about a 300-foot walkway into a room where we host the tasting. I won't give it away in case people come do it, which mm-hmm. we'd love. And then we sit down. And, Lynn, this is my favorite part. I get to sit down with people and have everyone introduce themselves when they're all listening to each other. And that introduction under blindfold gives people the illusion that it's just they're just talking to a group of people that are just sitting there listening to everything they have to say. And we can do it with any size group of people, because if someone's talking to a group of 40 people, they feel like it's just them and me, which makes it fun for all of us. People introduce themselves. Then we talk about wine aroma and wine flavor. And we smell 6 different aroma samples where I dissolve aroma compounds in a base wine. And we get an experience of what these things are. What does lemon smell like when all these people say, oh, I smell the lemon in there? Well, what are we smelling? What are we smelling when we talk about oak or vanilla or hazelnut? And we deal with this and we warm up our palates. And then we sit around and we smell wine and really give it the time of day and think about it for about 5 minutes per wine before we taste the wines. And we taste anywhere from 4 to 6 wines and discuss them, talk about the flavors, and we don't reveal what color or what varietal we think they are until the very end. And it gives people a great opportunity to just relax into their senses, focus their attention, not on the visual distractions they receive, but on the wine in the glass and on the spoken word of their friends around them, and really enjoy what wine truly has to offer, which is quite magnificent.
How do people react?
People come away saying, wow, I didn't think I'd want to be under blindfold for more than 5 minutes, but I realized the time went by extremely quickly. And people come away saying, I want to appreciate wine academically, and I never knew how to do that before. And that's what's such a joy for me, is because that's how I love to drink wine, is thinking about it and studying it and writing my tasting notes after everything I try and really delving into it.
But couldn't you do the same thing without the blindfold?
With the blindfold, it focuses your attention away from what it looks like around you, the distracting faces, you know, things like that, where you're really focusing just on the wine and not on the visual cues. Because vision is such a first response sense, it's a sense that we use all the time to pick things up. It often can be a bit of a crutch. When we don't have that sense, we can just focus all our attention on the task at hand.
Hmm.
One thing that I love about this tasting and about just talking with people in general, people so often focus on things they don't have. And I could do that all the time. You know, I'm a blind person. I had to get a ride to the studio this morning. That stuff's no big deal. The most important thing is to spend our time not focusing on what we don't have and focusing on what we do have. Maybe we don't know how to cook everything under the sun, but those things we know how to cook and those wines we know how to serve people around us are such a great resemblance of the wonders that we do have. And I think wine in particular is a tremendous way to forget about the disabilities we have, the fact that our knee hurts, you know, whatever's going on around us, the fact that we had a bad day at work. And just stop and think about wherever you are. There's beauty in some respect in anyone's life, in any part. And wine allows us to really slow down and really get into the wine and into what it's resembling and where the grapes were grown. We can forget about all those things around us that might be hindering us and focus on the positive.
Hobie, thanks so much for being with us.
Lynn, thank you.
Hobie Wedler leads Tasting in the Dark wine seminars at the Francis Ford Coppola Winery. And by the way, in 2012, the White House honored Hobie and 13 others as champions of change for leading the way for people with disabilities in the fields of science, technology, engineering, and math. Now, for a recipe to tune up your sense of smell, take a look at our warm white bean salad with fragrant garlic and rosemary. You're going to find it at splendidtable.org. The million-dollar question amongst food folk? What is the next kale? Could it be cactus? The prickly pear cactus, to be exact. Nopalitos, now that's the cactus paddles, and tunas, which are the pears of that cactus, are really popular in Mexico. And other countries aren't far behind. According to the UN, Ethiopia, Morocco, South Africa, Peru, Argentina, and Chile all have significant acreage given over to nopales. And southern Italians are mad for cactus fruit. Sicilians have grown them for years, and in fact, they're second only to Mexico in eating cactus fruit. Sam Brash, a contributing writer to Modern Farmer, joined Patty Hinnich in the studios at WAMU for the story behind the cactus.
Hi, Sam. So nice to be able to talk with you today.
Hi, Patty. You too. Great to be talking to you.
So I want to know, how did you run into the prickly pear cactus?
So we almost literally ran into the prickly pear cactus on a bike ride out here in Denver where I live. And we were biking out to a reservoir, and there was kind of a patch by the side of the trail, and we noticed just a number of people were picking the pears off the top of those cactuses. So we stopped, asked if we could see what they were doing, and they let us pick some with them, and then we brought them home and tried to eat the pears. And didn't really succeed, got pricked pretty bad, but managed to get a little taste of the fruit.
Okay, so now tell me, you had a taste of the fruit, which Mexicans call mm-hmm. tunas. What did it taste like?
Yes. Kind of like kiwi with the harder, bigger seeds in it.
And now tell me, have you tasted the cactus paddle or nopalitos, or did you just taste the fruit?
I have. I actually made a point of buying some of the nopalitos, the paddles, and cooking them with some of my friends. And we made nopalitos tacos. And it's great. It was kind of like a mixture between string beans and okra. I had read in researching the article that the main worry with the paddles is that they can kind of end up being a little bit slimy.
Yeah.
Well, we boiled them before we sauteed them with all the other good stuff that went into the tacos. And that really took care of it. So by the end of it, the texture was maybe a little bit more like green beans, but it had a stronger taste to it that I really liked.
Yeah, nice trick. And they have such a nice bite.
Yeah, they do. They do. I mean, it's one of those foods where you just got to wonder why it hasn't caught on more. You know, it did come when I bought it at the grocery store, as I'm sure you know, with the spine still attached. And much of our, like, worry and preparation was getting those spines off of it. And I did get pricked a little bit, but once only at the beginning. And after that, I really got to say it was no harder than peeling a cucumber.
Right. Now, let me ask you, Sam, who is growing them?
I found a couple of places, both of which were out in California, that are growing nopalitos and the tunas or the fruits. Most of the actual agricultural production is obviously in Mexico, but a few places are cropping up in the States. And one of those places is Darrigo Brothers Farms, and they put out cactus pears under the Andy Boy brand. Mm-hmm. And they have a dedicated 350 acres of just cactus, which makes them by far the largest cactus farm, you know, for food production in the United States.
That is huge. Now tell me, where does that last name come from? Doesn't sound Mexican.
Right. It's from my understanding, from what they told me, it's actually an Italian name. And most of their customers are still Italian immigrants because, I didn't realize this at all, but Italians, especially in Sicily and southern Italy, love eating the cactus fruit. And like I was saying, Mexico, according to the UN, is by far the largest producer, but number two is Italy.
Wait. And how did they get to Italy?
I've read Columbus. I haven't confirmed that. I'm not going to go out on a limb and say that, you know, that Columbus like showed up in Italy with a bunch of cactus pears and everybody fell in love with them. But it seems that at some point, trade with the New World brought those over to Italy, and it's become this real staple of Italian cooking.
Okay, now what's going on? Are they starting to sell the cactus paddles or the nopalitos?
Well, they are. It's a food that more and more people say is really, really good for all kinds of aspects of your health. You know, just to name a few, apparently the cactus paddle, it's full of fiber, it's full of vitamin C, it's full of antioxidants. And kind of the most interesting benefit of the cactus paddles is that it helps control blood sugar, which I didn't realize. So there's actually a lot of people who are ordering these cactus paddles online and buying them at the store who are using it as sort of a folk medicine to help treat diabetes and help regulate blood sugar.
It is one incredible ingredient, and I think as long as they sell them without the needles, they're going to really pick up. You know, this incredible ingredient, have you seen modern-day chefs using these nopalitos, or is it only the Mexican restaurants?
I have talked to one friend of mine here in Colorado named Adam Brock. He runs a food nonprofit. He knew of a chef who used the nopalitos in a salad. So I would imagine there are chefs out there who might not have an inclination towards Mexican cuisine, but have been starting to use this crop because of its, you know, not just its health benefits, but because it grows locally in places where there's not a lot of local, you know, crop. You know, for instance, in Colorado, so much of what we eat isn't native to Colorado. This is an example of a food that could be grown as a crop, but often just grows as a weed, you know, like I saw on the bike ride on the side of the road It's easy to grow. It requires no agricultural imports, or if it does, there, you know, very little water, very little pesticide, very little fertilizer. So I think it really appeals to chefs who are trying to reach that audience who's interested in local foods. And as far as, you know, these semi-arid or arid places, it can't get much more local than cactus.
Right. Well, Sam, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Fatty. It's been great.
Sam Brash's article, A Prickly Question, Could Cactus Be the Next Kale?, appeared in Modern Farmer. Patty Hinnich is host of Patty's Mexican Table, and you can find a recipe for grilled nopales on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, Mastering Brilliant Vegetables and White Teas Revealed. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Chef Daniel Patterson is one of the most thoughtful chefs in the business, and he's taking his cooking into a realm that could be our food of the future, but probably without the white tablecloths. At his Michelin two-starred restaurant, Qua, in San Francisco, you're going to eat like a king. 8 courses, seemingly simple, but full of surprises. For instance, a bowl of grits, that's really buttered popcorn, a tomato salad with olive oil, but not drizzled. Instead, it's frozen into a scoop of gelato. Yeah, it's vegetable-centric, but it's not vegetarian. Well, commentator Francis Lamb talked with Daniel Patterson.
So hi, Daniel. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Daniel, the first time I came to Qua and sat down and had the tasting menu, I was so blown away by the simplicity of it and how clear the flavors were and how surprising the textures were. I remember this really wonderful beet snow with rose and this upside-down tomato tart with these super intense little tomatoes. And, you know, I was so sad when it was over. But I also remember realizing that, wow, after 11 courses, I was counting, and there were only 2 that had any kind of meat or fish. Are you weaning your guests towards vegetarianism?
I'm hopefully not weaning them towards anything except delicious food. You know, I'm not vegetarian. I love cooking with vegetables, but, you know, there's kind of a crossover between what I like personally and what we serve in the restaurant, but it's not 100% one for one. So I don't go in with any kind of agenda except to make people happy. That's my agenda. You know, now, for example, we have California sturgeon caviar, which is a protein, you know. Mm-hmm. It comes from an animal. It's actually a pretty extraordinary product now. It's just gotten better and better. We've got gooey duck, which is a giant clam native to Washington, native to the West Coast. And we have lamb and crab, Dungeness crab, which is one of our best local products. So what is that? 4 things. Mm-hmm. But just a little bit of everything. But everything is there for a purpose, I guess.
But let's talk about the focus on vegetables. What do you enjoy about cooking with them? It seems like you're really inspired by them.
Yeah, it's a great question because, you know, I've tried to think about where did this come from? You know, I didn't necessarily grow up with it and I didn't learn it anywhere. When we talk about vegetables, we're talking about plants. And the whole right. plant kingdom is so vast. So we work with wild plants. And wild plants, it's like wild sage. There's 100 kinds of wild sage, and the same variety in 2 different places is going to taste totally different. It's like being a painter and someone gives you 100 new colors that no one's ever seen before or no one usually works with. Your ability to create something kind of fresh and new and to kind of look at the world in a new way is vastly increased. Mm. So what it does is it's like if you think about cooking as a language, vegetables give you a lot more vocabulary than if you're just cooking with meat. Because the fact is that different varieties of meat are going to taste much more similar than different varieties of a particular kind of herb or vegetable.
Yeah. Can you think of a dish that you've served that really makes you think, wow, that really shows something new about this plant?
You know, what I hope is that, you know, every dish shows a little something. So it's like, mm. I guess one of the things that we try and do is combine familiar and strange in a way that so familiarity is connection to culture, connection to tradition. I mean, food is about people, so we want to keep that connection to other people. You know, I'm just one speck on a long continuum of cooks over thousands of years, and I want to keep that connection there because that's where the emotional power is. But something new that you haven't seen before, well, that's like the shock of, you know, like excitement, you know, and you combine the two, and it's a very powerful kind of paradigm. So, you know, for example, the beet dish that you mentioned, the beets basically made to look like a rose, cut in such a way, very labor-intensive, a little bit of aerated yogurt and rose petal ice. Mm-hmm. And the rose petal ice is just made like a tea. It's only five ingredients. And something that I personally love is the challenge of making something with something really humble and making it as exciting as if the customer is getting something really foreign or kind of a traditional luxury ingredient. So to make, I mean, let's be honest, to make a beet as exciting as, you know, caviar or foie gras is, you know, it's got to be a pretty damn good beet.
Yeah.
So, you know, so the amount of creativity and imagination that goes into it, you know, when you're creating kind of a little bit of a limitation, I think limitations kind of force creativity.
Yeah.
So for me, what I would hope is like I've just eaten a beet that tastes intensely of beet, and yet the form is different, and what it's surrounded with is different, and the temperature and texture is not what I was expecting. So I get what I thought I was going to get, and then something a little bit more too.
Yeah, but you know, there's this idea of limitation that you've brought up. At the same time, you're also saying, well, one of the reasons why you love working with vegetables is because they add so many colors to your palate. In a sense, they relieve you of limitations or sort of a sense of what a limitation might be. At the same time, you also say you wouldn't want to be a vegetarian, that there's something about animal food, there's something about meat and fish that satisfies you in a way that just plants usually don't. What do you love about those foods?
It's a much bigger conversation around vegetarianism versus omnivorousness, let's just say.
Just from a deliciousness point of view.
Yeah, no, but I mean, even if you're talking from a deliciousness point of view, because then you're getting into the physiology of how your body responds to animal fats, which is very well. So the perception of deliciousness, for example, we have on the menu right now, lamb that's poached in oil that's a little bit kind of tinged with rosemary, and then it's at a low temperature, and then it's grilled over charcoal to finish it. And the smell of that is just like mouthwatering. And it satisfies a certain kind of craving in a different sort of way. I feel like I could replace that, but the fact is I don't cook in a vacuum. And I'm not cooking for some abstraction of what I think is a perfect meal.
Right.
I'm cooking for customers, my customers. And we've kind of tried a lot of things over the years. And I've learned what my customers like and don't like, how far I can go. And what's really important, what I've learned is that it makes them happy to have that primal sort of piece of meat, really well cooked, well cared for, like well raised, delicious. But if there's one moment of that in the meal, it's enough. And there's one thing to bend people's expectation. It's another thing to break it entirely past a point at which they become disappointed. Because restaurants and cooking, it's all expectation fulfillment. And the thing, the bedrock, the most important thing at Quah that we feel, we're cooking for people. We're not cooking for ourselves. And they would be disappointed if we did not have at least that one moment of a perfectly cooked, aromatic, just juicy and kind of almost that primal experience kind of piece of meat at one point in the meal.
Yeah.
And so that anchors in a sense and allows us to do what we want for the rest of the meal. And it gives us a lot of leeway.
Yeah. So thank you so much for joining us today, Daniel.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was great to be on.
Chef Daniel Patterson has the Michelin 2-starred restaurant Quah in San Francisco. Food writer Francis Lam is also editor-at-large for Clarkson Potter. Now, Daniel left us with a recipe for beets with bergamot, mint, and wildflowers. And you know where to find it, splendidtable.org. Whether Whether you've taken the leap from the tea bag and are now consumed by first flushes and tippy golden orange Picots or not, the world of tea is enormous and it just keeps expanding. Well, Bill Waddington of Tea Source is one of the people who's brought this on. He hunts down sources and brings back new revelations of the teapot. Bill, it is great to have you back.
It's great to be back here, Lynn.
Now, I've been hearing about white tea. Is this a gimmick or is this really your eyes have just gone wide? Obviously, this is not a gimmick.
Oh, white tea is definitely not a gimmick. It is one of the six categories of tea. Absolutely, absolutely. And it's really hot right now and growing in popularity tremendously the last 2, 3, 4 years or so. And it's kind of interesting because there's a huge controversy about white tea right now, too.
What's the controversy about?
You got to remember a little bit about what white tea for context. It's one of the six categories of tea, and it's the lightest of all teas. It's very soft, delicate, gentle, subtle, little sweet flavor to it. And up until 15 years ago, 97% of the white tea in the world came from three little villages in northern Fujian province. And then
In China.
And then America and Europe discovered white tea, even though it had been around forever. And these three little villages could no longer meet the demand for white tea by any stretch of the imagination. Mm-hmm. So white tea started being grown all over other parts of China and eventually all over the world, which led to a conundrum. Is it really white tea if it's not from where white tea was originally and where white tea was developed and from those same cultivar plants? And it's very similar to an issue that popped up in the alcoholic beverage industries with champagne.
Yes, exactly.
Exact same issue. And it's a question, is the product defined by geography or is it defined by the processing or and the end product, the end result that you get with?
The people who are growing it in other parts of the world, are they using the same cultivars? Are they using the same tea plants?
Originally, they did. They literally would take cuttings from those plants in those three little villages in Fujian, and they'd bring them to other parts of China. And they'd bring the tea masters with them to show them how to make it. But the demand for white tea has grown so much that now they are using other cultivars. Same processing techniques, absolutely. But there just wasn't enough of the original cultivars to meet the worldwide demand for white tea. It's one of the fastest growing categories of tea.
Let's talk about what is white tea.
Sure. White tea, well, it depends on who you're talking to a little bit. But I am a believer that the tea is defined by the processing, not the geography, because that's how all other categories of tea are defined, by how they process the leaf after it's plucked and the end result in the cup. That's what makes a tea a tea. White tea is the least processed of all tea, very minimal processing, basically letting the leaf wither and then letting the leaf dry and maybe a little shaping of the leaf. That's white tea. Very, very little is done to the leaf.
So you're saying letting the leaf dry, is it dried naturally in the sun?
Typically, they'll do what's called withering the leaf with solar withering in the sun for a matter of days, which is very unusual. Most tea categories are withered a matter of a few hours and usually indoors. White tea is typically withered over a matter of 2 to 4 to 5 days.
Hmm.
And then they do apply a gentle heat from a man-made source, whether it's electric heating tunnels, or they can fire it in big, gigantic woks. They apply some heat to pull more moisture out of the leaf and to kill any enzymes in the leaf so it doesn't mold and break down. But compared to any other tea, it's very minimal processing. It's almost just the raw leaf with a little bit of drying and heating done to it.
So a black tea, just as a contrast, a black tea would be dried,
yep.
And then what would happen to it?
It would be rolled and crushed, and then it would be oxidized, which means before you apply heat at the end, you let all those chemicals that you released from the leaf by rolling the leaf, you let those chemicals interact with the atmosphere, and the whole chemistry of the leaf changes through that process of oxidation. That's why it becomes black. White tea goes through zero oxidation. So it's gentle withering, gentle heat, maybe shaping the leaf, and you're done.
Am I right in remembering that I've seen the term wild tea attached to it?
You are absolutely right. I'm just like, wow, you really know your stuff.
No,
you surprise me sometimes. Oh, I shouldn't have said that, I guess.
It's understandable, Bill. I accept that.
I actually brought in a white tea today that is literally, it's the newest hippest thing on the specialty tea market. And it's made from wild tea trees from Yunnan province of China. So it's not in that same geographic region.
Right.
And I'm a believer that white tea is defined by process, not by geography. And it's literally made from wild tea trees up on the mountainsides of western Yunnan province, 2,000 miles away from where white tea began. And it's just an amazing tea.
So let's taste it.
All right. The name of the tea is Ya Bao. It's two words, two Chinese words. First one is Y-A, Ya. Second word is Bao, B-A-O. It translates as treasure bud or silver bud.
Okay. And you've poured some hot water now into these small tasting cups. These are what tasters use. But the tea leaf, oh, this doesn't look like any tea I've seen.
It's an amazing, it doesn't look like tea. The first time I saw this, I didn't think it was tea. I thought it was from some other plant entirely. I'd never seen it before.
It's a silvery beige, almost a tint of green to it. And what it looks like is the top bud of several small leaves that have dried and kind of clustered together.
You've pretty much nailed it there, Lynn. This is a tea that's only made once a year, either very, very late winter or very, very early spring. And it's from, again, tea trees that go 30, 40 feet up in the air. And at the end of the winter, at the end of the dormant season, they'll start putting out some new shoots and some new branches. And the very first thing that pops out from an existing branch is this little bud. They pluck these buds right off of the tea tree itself, and they process it just as they would process white tea leaves traditionally, and they make a white tea out of it.
Okay, so it's ready to be tested.
It's ready to be tested. Let me decant it here. And it's not going to taste like a typical white tea. It's still a light tea for sure. And I'm decanting the liquid.
Into a small white cup.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, my. It's almost clear. That's amazing. This tastes like a fruit. Almost as though something like a mango or a lychee nut, a fresh lychee nut, has been passed over very hot liquid.
Well, that's a great
and it's script. A whisper of it. And it's the gentlest thing I think I've ever had that was called tea. Okay, Bill, this is very special. Is it very pricey?
Good question. Compared to most white teas, not at all. This white tea, Ya Bao, is pretty much everyday price tea. Most white teas tend to get really, really pricey. This one's not.
Bill, this is really remarkable. I've never tasted anything like this. Thank you.
Thank you, Lynn. It's been great to be here.
Bill Waddington is proprietor of teasource.com. Now, you can find information on white teas on the website, splendidtable.org. Now, we're going to be back in a minute with your calls and a man who's putting road food duo Jane and Michael Stern to the test. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. It's time to connect with you. We're at 800-537-5252. And remember, you can always get in touch on Facebook and Twitter. You can send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. We have Adrian calling from Denver. Adrian, what would you like to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Thanks for taking my call.
You are welcome.
I want to talk about how to serve or make ravioli or tortellini in a broth.
Okay.
Yes, and I've been hesitant to do this because I'm afraid that it's going to be bland and the flavors aren't going to come together.
Well, it all depends on your broth.
And that's what I was thinking.
Yeah, this is a classic way to serve tortellini and ravioli. In fact, I can't imagine a Christmas dinner without it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and in the part of Italy where they claim to have invented tortellini, they claim the only way to serve it is in broth. Any other way to serve it is, well, it just isn't complimentary to the tortellini. But, you know, that's debated. But the point is, all you do is you make a really, really good chicken broth.
Okay.
Okay? And have you ever done some broth making?
I've made broth once before. I also have some duck stock frozen in my freezer. Would that be complimentary or would that be?
Oh, I think so. Oh, yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah. Just make sure it's completely defatted. You could have a few bits of fat in it. And yeah. Oh, I think your duck stock is just going to be fabulous.
Oh, and great.
The classic way to do this is you would cook the tortellini in the stock.
Okay.
And then you always have a bowl of freshly grated Parmigiano on the table.
Okay.
Because cheese is the finishing seasoning for pasta in broth. It's and it'll lift it. But yeah, it's a great trick. And by the way, there's a great trick if you don't have the best broth in the world, and maybe you only have boxed or canned broth. What you do is you chop up some celery, carrot, and onion. All right, saute them in a saucepan with a tiny bit of olive oil or butter. And get them a little bit brown, and then pour about 2 cups of white wine over them.
Ooh.
And boil that down to absolutely zero, okay? And then add a couple of cans of stock, a quart, or whatever amount you need of the prepared broth, and let that simmer about 20, 30 minutes. And you get a pretty sexy result without having to go through the 7 or 8 hours that you're going to need to make a really incredible homemade broth.
Okay.
So it's a good cheater's broth.
That sounds great. Would you, I've had it actually once in a restaurant before, and they actually had artichokes kind of in the broth along with the ravioli or the tortellini. And have you ever done it that way, where you've got another kind of component to the dish?
The first word, remember something, I'm Italian on both sides of my family. So I see, the first word that comes to my mind is barbaric. And I don't want to be insulting to these folks because it might have been delicious. But when you have really, really good filled pasta.
Yes.
Don't mess around with it.
Okay.
let the pasta really shine. And then maybe do a course where you have another kind of pasta that you've tossed with the artichokes and whatever else you want.
Okay. So could be a whole separate thing.
A whole separate number. Exactly.
Well, great. Well, thank you so much. This is very helpful.
You are welcome. You're going to become Italian by absorption.
Oh, sounds great. I love your show. Thanks again.
Thanks, Adrian. Take care. Bye.
You too.
Just a point I have to make. I mean, I really have to make this clear, okay? First of all, don't mess around when you have great filled pasta. You don't need fancy sauces. I mean, a little butter and cheese, maybe you fry some fresh sage, but that's it. I mean, taste really wonderful filled pasta as itself. And then if you want to fool around, but just give it a shot. There's something I've been doing lately. I realized I often go shopping for some of my more unusual herbs in Asian markets because they're much less expensive and there's huge turnover. So what happens is I use a few leaves of Thai basil or some interesting water mint, you know, from Vietnam, or mint or coriander, and then the rest of it goes bad. So what I've been doing instead is I've been making essentially flavoring blends and freezing them. You don't want to leave them in the fridge because they're going to go off. But freezing them, you kind of put them in suspension. So here's an instance. I will take a couple of bunches of coriander, also known as cilantro, and Chinese parsley, with stems and all, wash it, dry it, throw it in the food processor. I will add to that my classic trio of ginger, garlic, and chili. And I might add a little bit of sugar or some fish sauce or both. Now I have the whole foundation of doing a sauté, adding vegetables, adding broth or whatever, and I've got the basis of a dish. Or I can break off pieces of it because I freeze it flat in Ziploc bags, and I can add it to things. You know, I'm making corn in the summer. I can just let this defrost and put it in a dish with a little bit of oil, and that's what you would roll your corn in. So I think you get the idea. You could have a couple of bunches of parsley, and you turn that into something that feels very French. It could be with lots of grated lemon zest, and then you want shallots, and you want fresh tarragon, and you're off and running. That combination in something like rice tossed with cheese, even a feta cheese, could be fabulous. So use your imagination. But the idea is don't let those things go to waste. And you always freeze them. That's how they're going to stay. They're going to darken, but 90% of the time, you're going to be using them when you're cooking, and all herbs darken in cooking. 800-537-5252. That's how you can get us. And you can go to Facebook and Twitter. Eric is on the line from Kensington, Maryland. Eric, what's on your mind?
Hi, Lynn. I'm calling about fondue. Ordinary Swiss fondue.
The cheese fondue.
That's right, the cheese fondue.
Yeah, exactly, yes.
It's great in winter. It's great if we have guests. It requires minimum kitchen time while the guests are present, and it slows the meal to encourage conversation.
Exactly. You know, I hadn't thought of all of that, but you're right.
So what's not to love about that? Our only experience at a variety of fondue was a Gouda fondue we were offered in Amsterdam.
Okay.
It wasn't bad, but it was just overpowering.
Yeah. It's usually done... In Switzerland, it is often done with something on the order of a... I'm just trying to think of the cheese.
Emmentaler.
But an Emmentaler is a Swiss cheese, and usually something more like a Gruyere. Mm-hmm. And Emmentaler is sometimes mixed with it. I've seen mixtures where you have Gruyere and you have... in Switzerland, there's a cheese called Sprinz, and it's a lot like Parmigiano, good Parmigiano. So sometimes that mix works. But generally Gruyere, because it's nutty, it's not overwhelming, and it's really, really lovely, you know, and especially because you've got the wine in there. It's just lovely for it. So that's the cheese I would pick, a good Gruyere.
That's what we've been doing for years, and we're kind of feeling in a rut. We're wondering if there are other possibilities.
Well, you could start mixing up cheeses. First of all, try a Fontina from Italy.
Mm-hmm.
And you could blend that with, I've never done this, but I think it could be very, very interesting to do. To do something like a Fontina or stay with your Gruyere, but blend in a little bit of a triple creme cheese from France, like an Explorateur. Because, you know, one of these very rich but relatively mild cheeses, and it's going to take on another dimension entirely. And the other thing you could try is, what about a great cheddar? And in addition to dipping in with the bread, you dip in with apples, tart apples like Granny Smith's. That could really be fabulous. Does that sound like it might ring a bell for you?
Yes, it does. It sounds good.
Okay. And you know the one trick if it starts to curdle, right? The lemon juice trick?
No, never had that problem. Well, I usually use cornstarch to smooth it out.
Okay, well, that's great. But sometimes it starts to curdle because what happens is the cheese gets too hot and the protein, how can I explain it? The protein strands start to curl up very tightly. You know the way a fiddlehead fern looks? You know, like the top of a violin?
Yes.
And when they do that, all the liquid... This is Lynn's science, by the way. Any scientist listening to this is raising their eyes to heaven. But it gives you a basic idea. When they curl up like that and get tight, they squeeze out all their natural moisture. So you have liquid and you have curd. But if you add some acid, lemon juice is particularly good with the cheese. If you add acid, those protein strands just relax. They lay back. They reabsorb all their liquid. And they are very, very happy. And you have a smooth fondue. So if it ever curdles, or if you want to skip the cornstarch, that's what you can do.
Okay. I have one puzzle for you. That we've always used a white wine because it's the Swiss way of doing things.
Right.
But if we think about our romantic youth, whether it's real or imagined, it involves a hunk of cheese, a baguette, and a bottle of wine.
Right.
And the wine's always red.
You could easily use red wine. It's not going to look as attractive, but you could use red wine. And yes, that wasn't a romantic image. Don't you remember? I was on the next hillside from you with the same baguette and the wine and the cheese. And I was with this great looking guy who became my husband.
So red works besides the color?
Oh, yes, it will. It will. But make it a light-bodied red. And Switzerland produces them, but they're hard to get. But for instance, even a Tempranillo from Spain, think about a Beaujolais would be great. So that's the kind of thing you want to think about. But yeah, you could, of course you could do red and relive those glorious days.
Okay, thank you very much.
You are welcome. Thanks. Take care. Bye.
All right, bye-bye.
You can get to us at 800-537-5252 or shoot us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. All right. Can you imagine following in the footsteps of Jane and Michael Stern? I mean, literally. Actor and writer Matthew Arkin is on tour with the L.A. Theater Works production of The Graduate. Well, he's also a big fan of the Sterns, and now his touring schedule puts him in a unique position. He's been checking out the places that they rave about all over the country. Matthew, good to talk to you.
It's a pleasure to be here, Lynn.
Now, it looks to me like you signed up for this show so that you could eat your way around the country.
That's part of the reason. I love L.A. Theater Works. They do incredible work recording plays, classic plays, modern classics, older classics for NPR. They do this amazing work, and I've had the pleasure of working for them a number of times. But this is the first time I've gone on tour with them. And when I heard that we were going to be traveling around the country, I listened to your show, I followed Jane and Michael Stern's blog, and I thought, here's a chance to have my days free and hit some of these places that I've been hearing about. So I went to the roadfood.com website and plugged in every city that we're going to and found out where to go.
Well, first of all, the highlights. What so far have you found that's just been unforgettable?
The two best for me were a place in Queens called Tortelleria. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Tortelleria Nixtamal in Queens. And I went there with my son, Sam, and we had the most amazing lunch. Incredible Mexican food in the middle of a very mixed ethnic but seemed mostly Italian section of Queens. This beautiful, colorful restaurant, and some of the best guacamole I've ever had. And that's saying a lot for somebody who eats
California.
Mexican all the time in California.
Yeah.
They had a chili relleno taco, which I couldn't figure out what that would be, so I ordered it. And it was actually a small jalapeno, or actually a large jalapeno, in one of those small tortillas, which was roasted with cheese inside it. So it wasn't fried at all. It was just a fresh, roasted jalapeno with cheese inside it. It was very hot, but incredibly simple and incredibly delicious.
Good.
You can see them making them fresh while you're ordering your food. They're making those little street tortillas fresh.
Yeah, the ones that are about the size of the palm of your hand. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And then right around the corner from that place, we were full, but we walked around the corner and we saw a place called Mama's of Corona, which was a fresh cheese and sandwich shop that clearly had been there for a long time. And we went in there and bought sandwiches to have later in the day. And they were amazing. Fresh bread, fresh house-made mozzarella and tomato and basil and prosciutto. Very simple, incredibly delicious sandwiches.
I love this idea that two people go out for obviously a very light lunch and then walk around the corner to buy sandwiches for their next meal. This is true.
Well, my conversation around the breakfast table usually centers around figuring out what we're going to have for lunch. And then at lunch, we usually discuss where we're going for dinner. That's how I like to get through my meal.
It makes perfect sense to me. You know, don't you think? I think Queens is one of those, you know, you talk about cities that are overlooked, food towns that are overlooked. If Queens were not part of New York City or, you know, the overall New York area, it would be one of the great destination points in any other part of the country. There's so much there.
Oh, amazing neighborhoods. The Greek and Eastern European restaurants in Astoria, an incredible neighborhood.
Well, okay. Another find. Another great find.
Another find was La Barbecue in Austin. We got to Austin. It was in the 20s, believe it or not. The city seemed empty because I guess that's very cold for Texas. And I looked on the Road Food website, and there was this barbecue place called La Barbecue. I walked for about a mile and a half in the cold to get there. And when I got there, it was a food truck with tables and tents set up. There was one gentleman finishing a sandwich. He left as I sat down with my sandwich. I got the El Sancho, but I got it loco style, which means instead of just chopped brisket or pulled pork or their sliced house-made sausage, you get it with a mix of all three meats, and it's topped with a an incredibly tart, fresh red onion coleslaw, which just perfectly complemented the barbecue. So I sat alone in 29 degrees at a picnic table eating this incredible sandwich outside of this truck. And I thought to myself, I thought Texas has this reputation of being this incredibly tough state. Where is everybody? This is the best barbecue I've ever had, and I'm sitting here eating it alone.
Well, I figured this way. Maybe it was that they knew that it was going to get warm, and they had 364 other days to eat the barbecue?
That's probably it. And I'm the Yankee idiot sitting there in 29
but
degrees.
But you don't have 364 other days.
No, I had one chance to get to this place and one chance only, and I'm so glad I did.
Well, good luck with the show, and keep us posted on, you know, latest adventures at the table, okay?
Will do. Thank you so much, Lynn.
Oh, thank you, Matthew. Bye.
Take care. Bye.
Actor and writer Matthew Arkin is author of In the Country of the Blind, and he's touring with the LA Theater Works production of The Graduate. Well, that's it for today. Be sure to join us next week. And in the meantime, let me leave you with this thought from Charles Kuralt, who said, "You can find your way across the country using burger joints the way a navigator uses stars." The Splendid Table is produced by APM American Public Media. Take a look at our website, splendidtable.org, to get information on just about anything you heard here today. Browse through our recipes, visit our online store, get registered for our podcast and weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, and check out our e-books, Eating In with Lynn. You know where, splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Laura Kalibi. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.